trick question?
Yeah, where's the middle of the road?
No, I'm just wondering. So you preach sometimes?
I do.
Okay. You preach sometimes? What are the times?
What are the times when I'm asked to a congregation?
2002-14.
Why did you come?
Just to listen.
The reason I ask the question is we as a team struggle whether this should be advertised for proclaimers or for everybody, because sometimes preaching looks like a mystery to people who don't do it, like some kind of a secret society or something. So we keep sort of wondering how this should be done. To date, we've only done it with pastors, but there are always a few lay people who, and sometimes pastors' spouses, who want to know what they're doing so late Saturday night.
As a lay person, I had no idea that proclaiming the word meant for preachers.
And you know, it's a misnomer because we've just been saying they're all proclaimers of the word, that whole liturgy of the word. It's not just for preachers, but if you would like to go. Well, let me read to you from the Gospel of Luke, the 4th chapter. This was the gospel reading at my ordination, and maybe was the gospel reading at some of yours as well. This follows the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. Then Jesus, filled with the power of the Spirit, returned to Galilee, and a report about him spread through all the surrounding country. He began to teach in their synagogues and was praised by everyone. When he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." He rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. Then he began to say to them, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. They said, "Is not this Joseph's son?" And he said to them, "Doubtless you will quote to me this Proverbs, 'Doctor, cure yourself.' And you will say, 'Do here also in your hometown the things that we have heard you did in Capernaum.' And he said, 'Truly I tell you, no prophet is accepted in the prophet's hometown. But the truth is, there were many widows in Israel in the time of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, and there was a severe famine over all the land. Yet Elijah was sent to none of them, except to the widow at Zarephath in Sidon. There were also many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed except Naaman the Syrian. When they heard this, all in the synagogue were filled with rage. They got up, drove him out of the town, and led him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so that they might hurl him off the cliff. But he passed through the midst of them and went on his way. How many of you have that read at your ordinations? How many of you had the first half read? Just about they were all amazed. The story of my ordination is I had chosen as the gospel text the first part of Luke 4, ending indeed with your laugh line. Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. My father, an older and wiser pastor than I probably ever will be, said if you're going to read Luke 4, read to the whole end of that text, where when he finally speaks the truth that reveals to them that the insiders are not automatically the receivers of the blessings of God, but that the only leper claimed was the Syrian. Read as far to the point that the congregation turns on this one about whom they had just been amazed, and seek to throw him not only out of the synagogue, but out of town and down the cliff. And read to the last line, he said. He passed through the midst and went on his way. The wisdom of my father is a wisdom that I keep taking to heart because my proclivity as a middle child who loves to make peace and who always sat in the middle seat in the back of the car to keep my younger siblings from fighting, I am inclined to just preach good news to the poor. I am inclined to just preach the sermon that when it's over, they say, "Oh, what beautiful things came from her mouth." Or as one woman said to me not too long ago, "I heard you preach once when I was a student at PLU. I have no memory of what you said. I just sat there and thought, these words are golden." Always more deeply into the task of preaching, which at least the Lutherans among us have to claim in our confessions, is the proclamation both of law and of gospel. It is the holding up of that fearful mirror that Nathan has. Until we see ourselves reflected there. For those of you who have preached the whole Word of God and came close or maybe had been run out of your parishes and out of town and off the cliff, if that preaching was done in fidelity to your call in this Word, then Jesus stands with you. And what I think my father hoped I would hear is that were that to become the case in my ministry, the promise of Christ for the preacher is, he'll be with you also when you pass through their midst and go on your way. There is a blessing for preachers in this text. And there is the warning that that we not stop too soon in our proclamation. There is also in this text an amazing glimpse into worship in the synagogue. Growing numbers of scholars believe that at the time of Jesus in Jewish worship in the synagogue, there was in fact a lectionary. Always one reading from one of the first five books, the Pentateuch, the Torah, and another reading set side by side to challenge, to confront, to encourage one another in conversation. And that, in fact, this is exactly what Jesus was doing, lectionary preaching. Notice it doesn't say Jesus took the scroll of his choosing, found the place on the scroll that he wanted to use to speak. But listen to this. He went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. The text was given to him. By whom? By a whole community of believers, of rabbis and of the faithful gathered. The community saying, these are the texts set side by side, week after Sabbath after Sabbath, that these assemblies need to hear in order to hear the whole Word of God. The texts are given to us in some large sense by a church much bigger than we are. Yeah. So I'm struck by that little line. He stands up to read and they say, well, here's the reading. It's Isaiah. Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant. Now, this is a well-trained acolyte. And those of you who can really get young people to be there when the book needs to be taken out of their bag also and sat down. This is his way now of saying, as a rabbi, this is the time of our teaching because rabbis taught. And then he reads this ancient text out of Isaiah that his people have heard, you know, a thousand times. Maybe have it written on their hearts even. Maybe can even mouth the words with him as he reads them. And then what does he do with this text? How does he preach on this text?
Today this has been fulfilled in your hearing.
With authority. With authority, that's true. We'll get to that, because that's a tricky thing too, isn't it? Maybe more for women, claiming the authority of the office without looking... someone said to me after I spun off about claiming the role of the presider if you're ordained, said, well, you have some strong opinions. And my immediate response was, oh, I'm sorry, I'm actually probably wrong about this. There's always room for late presidency when it blah, 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 you know. Instead of saying, indeed I do. Do you also have strong opinions? But that immediate response, sort of back down of anything said too strongly, lest what? We look
strident, shrewish.
That's the word. Yeah, a one who does not want to be tamed. What he does in saying this text has been fulfilled in your hearing is he is doing what we are all called to do when we preach this text. He's pointing to Christ. He is drawing people to this, the fulfillment, God's fulfillment of the word. His preaching breaks open in their midst his presence for them. And at its basis form, that really is all that our task is about, is proclaiming Christ in the end. And I know there's such a clamoring for more helpful sermons. You know, affecting relationships. And I remember at PLU, every time I drove past Parkland Christian, and their title of their sermon would be up there, and I would think, you know, that looks really helpful to people. I mean, I'd like to know how to build a stronger marriage, how to communicate with my children, how to manage my money wisely. You know, these would be the topics. And I could even in myself feel the pull. I mean, those were on the days when I didn't just, you know, a couple of reactions you can have, you know, and say, where's the cross in that? Oh, I don't know, maybe the cross was there. Did I ever go and hear it? No. But I know there is a clamoring for that. But at its root, whether it ends up being helpful or not for the practical living of life, the heart of our calling is to proclaim Christ, to reveal Christ among us now, fulfilling the word of God, even now in our midst. And it's easier said than done. But then as Jesus goes on in his preaching, once they think it's sweet, you know, that this is, oh, what a lovely word, all those words flowing, so golden. Then he realizes that his task isn't done. And he needs to turn it another way. They realize that the fulfillment of God's word is going to, as the Magnificat says, you know, bring the mighty down from their thrones and lift up those of low degree. Yes.
When Jesus makes his statement, he's giving, in a sense, a personal testimony. Is that something that ought to be done? And if so, how does one avoid arrogance? This could have been seen as rather arrogant.
Personal testimony, as opposed to first-person singular stories? Really, the testimony of my believing?
Yeah.
What do you think? How many of you give personal testimonies in your... or have tried that or wonder about it. You do? Mm-hmm. Yeah?
I've heard that one of the preachers, but it sounds more about them than about Jesus. One of the common criticism we get is we talk more about ourselves than about Jesus. I remember in homiletics class, I had Rognes and Preuss and Arne Halvorsen. The evaluations everybody has to fill out was, can Christ be clearly seen in the sermon?
Yeah, that's a good...
I mean, I think there's a way to talk about yourself that's transparent, that leads people into themselves, rather than looking at you. And I'll tell you just a very quick story. The former dean of the cathedral, when I was 26, he was 86, and he was the emeritus person there. And once I invited him to my home, and I thought, oh, I can't wait to show him my study. So you can see all these books. And I was just so proud. I was 26 of all my books. And he said, dear, you need to learn how to use a library. The next thing he said to me after he heard me preach a few times, he said, you know, you're very good. You have something to offer. But he said, you know what? You quote too much. He said, dear, the people want to know what you believe, not what you've read. And that stuck in my head too. So I think it has to do with, can you speak in such a way, not that they look at you, but at themselves and at Christ.
And there's some authority in that.
Right. And some authenticity. Yeah. There's not something self-revelatory. I have a hard time
preparing a sermon. I would maybe be able to live with myself in a certain kind of a personal testimony of my faith, if it were equally balanced with a personal testimony of my doubt and unbelief and shakiness. Yep. And yet that's not our task. If we set up in the sermon that people will be drawn to the faith because I believe, or will come to church because they know Susan has such a strong faith, in a way we've misunderstood our task. Luther is clear that the proclamation of the gospel and the efficacy of the sacrament has nothing to do with the faith of the preacher.
It's not my faith.
No, it's not your faith.
It's the faith that, you know, I proclaim the faith of Jesus. Sometimes, not it. You know, we talk about faith, having faith in Jesus. I like to talk about it in terms of the faith of Jesus. Who is truly faithful?
Mm-hmm. That's good.
at the same time, I think that your passion, your faith reveals. I mean, there's something, it's alive for you. I want to know that God that's alive.
Without saying too much about it.
You know, yeah. I've been in groups of pastors to have them confess, I don't believe what I'm proclaiming. And that really scares me, because that's going to, no matter if they're the most eloquent preachers, if they don't believe it, they're not going to have that passion and that personal conviction that comes from owning the text and believing it and struggling with it.
I would say to that, even in my times of deep doubt, great unbelief, despair, and complete apostasy, I'm not just speaking for myself, am I here?
No.
My task still is to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that task, that office, calls me to do exactly that with as much passion as I can, and that it is not dependent on whether I'm at the moment believing this. God have mercy on us all. If the preacher can only preach to the degree of that preacher's faith at the moment. And it seems to me that what helps is to think again of our role as an office. We're called to preach this gospel. And I find it a supreme act of faith in the deepest sense of the word. Trust that I am not going to be in this time of unbelief forever. I am at that moment preaching the gospel to myself, that I might hear and believe again in this saving word.
We preach what we most need to hear.
We preach what we most need to hear. And if my faith is always just illuminatingly strong and my words sweetly golden, then I could come into the point of thinking, no, I really don't need to hear the gospel.
But can you understand that for people in the pew, it's a gift to know that? Because they walk the same journey. Yeah.
The gift to know that I struggle or that I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. That for all of us, it's a journey through hills and valleys. And that God is with us on every step of that journey. And I'm not saying get up there and do your therapy in front of the congregation. But I do think there is a place to share something about your faith story that points to the one.
Then I don't know how you're using that pronoun, if it's a singular or a plural right here. Mm-hmm. You're saying you, Susan, or
oh, no.
Okay.
No.
Because I think for those of you for whom it is authentic to do that, and you really have a sense that it is a transparent first-person relation that does draw people in into Christ more deeply, then that's a decision about your own style. I find that I am moving farther and farther away from any use of the first-person singular pronoun in preaching. Mm-hmm. It's a major move over the last 20 years for me. It's just my evolution. And I think in part, I don't know why it is.
From that to what?
Preaching
Jesus
Christ. Okay. I almost never say I. But I'm not recommending this to you. If you can use that effect. Once in a while, I'll use an image that comes up out of my past or tell a story. But it's interesting that when you read stuff about Gen X people, whoever they are, that they aren't really, the stories they like best from their preacher is about how you screwed it up. Mm-hmm. It's sort of how you look vulnerable and you look just as clumsy as they do. And I think that has its place if it is met also with a strong word. If you end your sermon sort of, well, you know, we're just all in this boat together and we'll just hang on to each other because there's nothing else to hang on to, that isn't the gospel in the end either. So, yeah.
Yeah, what I found, I don't preach anymore, but what I found worked best is I would talk about myself
in the law section, so to speak, in the law section. Because if I tell a funny story, for example, or not necessarily funny, about my meeting with the law, then it's kind of like a story where it says you are the one in the end, where there kind of goes by, and because we're talking about me, but we're really not talking about me, because we're talking about everybody.
In a sense, you use your story parabolically tell it in such a way that they can go.
And then that's the law section, but then the gospel, you give it all to Christ, because I have nothing to do with the gospel part of it, really.
But then you've got to include yourself as a recipient of that.
A recipient, a redeemed, but just, I feel like the focus in the gospel section is much more no first person, because it's about what Christ has done.
Is that helpful to people to think of it that way? One back here and then back over here.
I was going to chime in. My preaching is very similar, that I'm the law example, and try to use that as an invitation, kind of tag onto that some sense of, and you've all been there too, we've all been there, where you're at the bottom of the barrel, or you don't get it, or you mess it up again, and this is what Jesus...
But I'm guessing you're not actually using this as a public confessional.
Right. It's a story.
But you know what I mean? I don't think preaching is the time for the pastor to get up and publicly confess her sins at this point.
That would be therapy.
Right.
You know? Well, I've heard it done, Carla.
My litmus test on using examples from my own personal life or my family life or close friends, whose identities are disguised to protect the guilty, is that if I am the hero of the story, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work, yeah.
If I am the foil in the story, it works. But that the hero role, if that attaches to a person,
I think
it's
that's
not the gospel.
And that's very Gen X. I mean, that's what they want. That's what apparently a lot of young people want to see. That's exactly right. That you can't be the hero of your own story.
It's hard to compare our testimonies about Jesus to Jesus' testimonies about Jesus.
Well, I think maybe that's just
like we can use it in the law. He uses it in the gospel.
Chris?
Well, I was thinking in a similar line. I don't use an I story much. But if I'm thinking about it, one of the things I try to ask myself imaginatively is, is Mrs. Smith, when she goes out the door, going to remember more about my upbringing, my dysfunctional family, whatever it is I'm talking about in the story, and never, if that's what's going to stick out in the hearer's mind more than the gospel, then I've taken a wrong turn.
Yeah.
If I somehow can use a personal story that gets to the gospel, and they don't remember, even in a sense, the vehicle I used to get there, then maybe it's okay.
So what we're all kind of saying is the question is, does it serve Christ?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And can we personally be our own judges about that? My prime example is that as sermon Dan has heard and Beth has heard, and maybe, I don't know if Laura Sonia was still in the, I don't think so, told this story about the first time I fell in love and being in San Francisco and walking across the Golden Gate Bridge with this guy. He was selling used cars on Van Ness Avenue, but actually he was a poet at heart, of course, and had an English degree from Ann Arbor, and he had gone on a blind date, and we started walking up. I mean, it's really the most romantic bridge in the world, I think. Ever since London Bridge went to the desert. And I was explaining this feeling that I was getting. And I thought, this is love. I got it in my knees, that kind of little... And then he touched me, and then I got it all through my body. And then these butterflies in my stomach, and the traffic's going by, and the waves are going by. And I just thought, well, whatever, this is it. And then he put his leather jacket on me. God. So, telling this whole story about falling in love and then getting to the top of the bridge and leaning over and heaving my guts out from the motion sickness of the bridge swaying in the water. And I had totally mistaken
love for nausea. I have more students. Were you there that year when I talked? Who remember that story and have a clue?
I remember it.
Have a clue that it was a sermon about the false things we hold on to, mistaking. I mean, they just didn't get that at all. And that was a powerful lesson to me, that this wonderful story, well told, well just eclipsed everything else. And that's when I started backing off and saying, you know, even sometimes smaller stories end up being the one thing Mrs. Smith remembers, that time you threw up on his leather jacket.
So I'm wondering how to, would you not use that? You said you backed off of personal stories, but anything can take the power of the sermon away from the gospel that you want to have the power. If you were to use that story again, how would you tweak it, or what would you do differently, or how would you give the power to Jesus instead of to the barfing?
There was something about, and maybe this is a clue for all of us, but something about proportionality. And something about maybe there was more energy and more humor and those other things that carry meaning to the hearts of people around the story than around whatever I had to say before or after that. It's too good a story as it is told well to use in a sermon, because, you know, when I really tell it well, you don't want to muck it up with the gospel. Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, a sermon is also a give and take, too, and it's what's in the minds of the hearer when they hear it. And I've, you know, experienced where... even when you're proclaiming the gospel, the person could be totally fixated on something totally different. And I did a sermon once in seminary where I said something, and it was kind of just the introduction, saying how close finals were or something like that. And the person heard that and started worrying about finals and never heard a single thing after that.
And
so,
I
mean, you can't, some of it you can't control. And on the other hand, things that I thought were minor were what the Holy Spirit used to share the gospel with the person, and I was like, you got what? I didn't say that, you know, but they heard it.
Which is another piece of this text that we need to remember. Then Jesus, filled with the power of the Spirit, returned to Galilee. But in the end, that is the power of our preaching, and we say that. But I think we need to believe it somehow, trust it when we're preparing.
I was wondering if you could say more about when we say that we're to proclaim the gospel of Christ, how do we keep that from being something that's just a belief? And it seems, because it's, and I don't know, maybe I'm just, sometimes it just seems like it's so easy to say we're supposed to proclaim the gospel of Christ. Because it seems like our job is to help parse it out.
Yes.
And help people understand what that means.
Yes.
And so that they really, when they're confronted with what it means to, you know, the blind and the lame. And because it doesn't seem like Jesus was saying, believe in me, believe in me, believe in me. He was always pointing to the reign of God.
Absolutely.
And so can you, because sometimes it just feels like it's so cliche-ish or so like, proclaim the gospel.
But see, I would never use that language in a sermon. I'm here to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ to you. I mean, that has to be unpacked. Those are so many words that, beginning with gospel.
But we do, there are sermons that all of us, I mean, and I hear, you know, that we say, you know, and God has given us the gospel of Christ. You know, we can say something like that in a sermon, you know.
Susan?
Let me respond. Unless, do you want to respond to her, John?
No, go ahead.
Some wise person said something about, I'm tired of going to church and hearing the preacher read the menu to me. I'm ready to go to church and eat the food. And I've puzzled over what exactly does that mean?
And maybe language like we've been given the gospel of Jesus Christ is reading the menu. And this is what God offers: health, salvation, life eternal, forgiveness of sins, accept it and go forth. And that it is sometimes narrative or story. For me, more and more often, narrative is story that comes up out of the text or up out of the world. That opens up what that means today at this moment, and we are always turning that. In some ways, we can't ever preach the whole gospel on a given... We're episodic theologians. We're not systematic theologians. And you turn it, and you in this day, this is what opens up as good news, as mercy, as healing, whatever the metaphor is, however the season shapes that, the texts give rise to it. But I think a good discipline. How many of you write texts of sermon and preach from texts? From written texts? Oh, the written word is still alive. Former English teacher likes that. To go through that text and circle every time you've fallen into one of those phrases that you know what it means, but it's really a shorthand. It's what in Old English they call it canning, like a fossil. It's like a whole poem squished down into one little thing, and it's so tight you can't get inside it. And part of what our task is, I think, is to break open those theological kennings and enflesh them in what's going around, you know, and in the language of the world and in the language of our hearers. And so that, I think what this man was saying, so they could experience this as good news and not just be told that there was good news for them. I still struggle with that because I think I read menus sometimes. I really do when I preach. And I have less confidence in my preaching today than I did 15, 20 years ago. And I'm more frightened of it. I all of that. Yeah.
Do you find yourself having to preach to strangers or contacts?
Well, that's part of. I don't have a call. I don't have a parish, and so.
You just
don't know what the context is. It's like, okay, generic. Information, and there's no lived. Which is why that falling in love story I thought was so perfect, because I was preaching to 19, 20, 21-year-olds who were mistaking love, falling in love, falling out of love, and I thought, perfect, you know, they'll see how stupid I was. And they did see that, and that's all they saw.
You kind of answered it already, but I think what I'm trying to do more, and it's more what Eugene Lowry talks about in narrative preaching. And I mean, in fact, the first time I ever heard you preach was at the Biberg lectures when Eugene Lowry was the main speaker.
And he never once came to hear me preach. Did you notice that?
No, I didn't notice that.
And I used a Lowry loop in one of them.
Ooh. Now I went out and went wine tasting with him. I had a good
That's
time.
That's where he was.
Well, I heard him preach every time, of course. But that idea of narrative, of bringing. I mean, instead of it being stories so much about myself, and I do some sometimes, but I think I'm probably like you, moving away from that after 20 years of this.
Don't you find yourself less and less interesting all the time?
I think so.
Yeah. And I assume people are less and less interested. You know, they say, what do they say, in your 20s you're worried that everybody's talking about you, and in your 30s, I can't remember because I'm in my 50s. In your 30s, and then you think they've stopped talking about you. But finally, when you're 50, you realize they never were and never will be talking about you. I mean, I think that's part of, and maybe it's an age thing, and that we have different preaching styles at different ages. Mm-hmm. You're probably a much more interesting believer and doubter and sinner than I am at some level, you know? So I think we also grow into our styles. We have styles befitting our incarnation at the time. Bethy and then, or Bethany.
To go back to language, there was a woman in my internship parish that was really, Kathy Green, such a gift.
to me in that she was on my internship committee, and they all had to have copies of my sermons when I preached. She would circle, and she's a Unitarian, but for some reason was drawn to this parish for a variety of reasons, but she was a wonderful critique. She would circle what she called insider language in all my sermons, because she was an outsider.
Yeah.
She wasn't raised in the church. She didn't know the language. She didn't know gospel, proclamation, all that. And yet I think about that now, and it's still helpful to me, but to some extent, I think it's not only the outsiders who don't know this language anymore. The insiders don't know the language either. And yet... I'm not willing to let go, perhaps I should be, of words like sin. I want the insiders to know what the word sin means, and yet have it be accessible to outsiders. Or if I say gospel, what I mean by that. And so sometimes I'm finding myself, and I would just be interested in some comment, that I'll use the word gospel, but then I'll have a phrase that, use the word gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, crucified and risen, or if I say sin, all that which separates us from the love of God, to almost define the word after using it. Then my hope is that it be understood, but that we don't have to give up all of our language.
We don't. It's what Beth has described as the perfect use of the dependent clause, the adjectival dependent clause. And I think once we learn how to use dependent clauses, we can use a lot of language. It has to be defined and unpacked. Even grace.
Especially grace. Mm-hmm.
Well, but I mean, people think they know that word.
Is that the one we need to...
Yeah, oh, there you go.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have your hand up first? No. Okay.
Kind of along that same line, and I'm showing my age here, but... For me, part of what I remember about sermons was when the preacher would bring in references to Bible stories, and it would enlighten and enhance and make the sermon fuller. And we can't do that, because people don't know the stories. And so it's the same kind of thing that Beth is talking about. Unless you use Jonah, and you talk about his foolishness in disputing God, the whole point of speaking about Jonah is lost.
In a recent survey, they realized that more than half of the people surveyed thought it was Jonah and the ark. So even Jonah doesn't work.
Well, VeggieTales is coming out with the Veggie Jonas.
Yeah, there you go.
But I think
so
that's...
So then we'll think it's an asparagus.
Yes. Crossroads here. And it does make me feel old too. I'm kind of, in some ways, an old-fashioned biblical preacher. But these images, these stories, these words, these phrases, this poetry is the vocabulary I have to work with. I mean, I was raised in a family where our jokes were biblical jokes. I mean, you had to know something to get them. And that's, I'll just tell you, when my mother turned 40, she said, I do not want this day acknowledged. I don't want a party. I don't want people to know about it. I simply want it to pass as another day. And we all said, fine. So she made dinner. Six of us gathered around the table. We ate the dinner. No one mentioned it. At the very end, when we usually had our devotions, my dad said, We pray and are excused just to ask your kids a couple of questions. How many days was Noah in the ark? We went around the table. John, how many days? How many days was Jesus tempted in the ark? How many years did he... And he did about six of these, and we knew all the answers. And then by the end, we knew what the answer was. And he was asking questions to which we had no idea what the real answer was, but we were just shouting, 40, 40, 40. And when we were all done, he says, very good, you may be excused. See, now that's not going to work in most American homes. I think the part of preaching in this new century is learning a new language. I don't want to release the language of Scripture. I mean, I want to say let's make our people biblically literate again. But I think there is a new language we need to learn, and it's the language of the ordinary folk out there. Luther went to the milkmaid and the farmer and his family and his barber to find out, well, how would you say this in German so that when I translate the New Testament, you'll hear it as words for you. I think we have to figure out what those are. And I was so much better at that when I was a campus pastor. Because, you know, the only thing better would be to be a junior high school teacher, and then you get it really fast. But, you know, I finally had to get internet in my home, though I resisted this because I thought, this is the language of the culture. You know, if I don't know what Google is, then I've missed out on a whole opportunity to talk about where you go to find what you don't know. Yeah.
In turn, you know, you said earlier that you felt... in the role as a preacher. One, as far as I'm concerned, you're truly gifted. And I don't say that because you're a friend or somebody, the bishop's wife. I say that because I think it's really true. But I think the difficulty is precisely that you do not have, you're not connected with a community. I've spent almost 11 years at the First Lutheran in Pasco, and I'm a much better preacher now because we know, we have shared the deaths of infants. We have shared the deaths of the ancients, the people who formed us, and I have a supreme advantage because of that.
And to those of you who have a call that a community of people has actually said to you, you're the one we want to stand in our midst and break open this word among us week after week. And there'll be days we want to throw you off the cliff. And there'll be days when we harden our hearts and close our ears, but please remain faithful to that call. I mean, I would urge you as pastors to cherish that and to cherish the community that keeps reflecting back to you your own need for the gospel and the invitation you have into the depths of people's lives, to their falling in and out of love, their miscarriages and their births and their marriages and their divorces and their deaths and their struggles. That is really where the stuff of preaching happens. And it's why I'm very uncomfortable in a way with this task, because I don't have that. And you are actually the ones who have that now. And so I tell you, forget these online sermons. I mean, I know too many people who download their sermons and preach them as if this word could just be transported any place. It's like digging out an old sermon from a previous call and looking at it saying, where was I?
Yeah.
Well, you were with that community at that time, with that world, and those rumors of war and war. I mean, that's where you were. And maybe there's a little picture or a little turn that actually can flow into something in your preaching, but it's never, doesn't work, does it? I mean, Father Chris?
Well, you're kind of getting in the direction I was interested in going, and that is the whole problem of what Jewish Lutherans call law, preaching the hard stuff, what in the Catholic tradition I sometimes come against. If we preach too challenging the gospel, we preach on a controversial topic of justice or peace. And my experience, when I did some of that in my first year in the parish, it went hardly anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
After 4 years of walking with the people and trust being built, and I guess it's not a question so much as a comment. I just really find that preaching the hard stuff, preaching justice, preaching peace, really requires a lot of artistry and a lot more craft, but especially trust built with the community, if they're going to receive it, and that the trust has been built through attending infants when they're dying, and grandmas and grandpas when they're dying, and showing up in the middle of the night sometimes.
Yeah, I think
then,
that's right.
Then they'll listen.
But you always have to watch that you're not preaching your own agenda or your own politics. Again, it's drawn back to who Jesus is and what Jesus calls us to do. I mean, politics do belong in the pulpit because this politics is the work of the people. And it does belong here, but finally, it's got to be the gospel. It's got to be Jesus who... It's got to be God revealed to us in Jesus, I guess, is the better language. Yeah.
There's been a time twice in the last couple of years where there's been some very intense pastoral issues in one family and then another. And a trap I found myself falling into, but I learned something from, is when the Sunday came up, I found myself preaching a sermon for that family, you know, and for that family alone. Because, you know, that whole week, whatever the text was, I was reading in the light of that one story, because that one story was so powerful for me. And it probably hooked into pieces of my own life, of course. And so what, but I was very conscious, you're not preaching to that one family. So what I've done a couple times, in the way that your therapist will say, well, if you're mad at your mother, even though she's dead, write her a letter and don't mail it. You know, or if you want to work through something with a person you're hooked on to in a way that's not healthy, write something and never send it. I've done it twice now, and it's been wonderful for me, is I've preached a sermon for that family. And I've offered it and just held it.
You didn't?
I didn't send it to them. I didn't mail it to them. I didn't. I might have some of what came out in it. I would pray with them, perhaps. But it's almost like falling in love in that sense. You sort of, you know, fall in love with the power of a particular family story. And then you can't think of the gospel in any other way. And yet, it would be too transparent.
Yeah. No, that's right.
And it isn't everybody's story anyway.
Right.
But in those two times, it was tremendously cathartic for me and for the preacher in me to preach that and to write it. And then I could think about the whole community.
Yeah.
So I just share that.
That is really helpful because that image of falling in love with a family and a family story.
Yes.
Sometimes those individual families, depending on who they are. I remember when the basketball coach at St. who was known throughout the community, he announced to the congregation when he was diagnosed with cancer, he asked for prayers, he was open about the disease, open about his faith, open about his doubts. The whole parish really journeyed with this man to his death. And our pastors never preached him, but there was a moment when, in the face of our own sicknesses and dyings and brokenness, to preach the one that he held on to the very end. And he was beloved because he was a winning basketball coach. He had, you know, tons of young men who just thought the world of him, whose lives he had shaped. And that was a way in which his story had become our whole story. And I think even a person walking in the first day for the first time would say, get this, I get this. But that was just beautifully, beautifully done. And I didn't know the man at all.
Just had a question, yeah, too, and I don't know if anyone wants to talk about it, but say a little bit about funeral homilies. I'd love to just talk a little bit.
Alex, just a second, and then we'll do
about I'd love to hear from you and from others if we have time.
I think if I had good hindsight, I would say I first experienced my call to ministry when I was 10 and asked my dad if I could accompany him on all of his funerals. And I went to more funerals for the next 3 years. My dad's preaching at funerals was so clear. This word was life and death. This word was absolute truth. This word was pointed to the context. And I think that's actually where I learned to preach.
Yeah.
And what a ministry he did, because, you know, sometimes tangentially related to the church and who would be there, you know. But it was if he took those opportunities not only to comfort the family that was bereaved and to speak a word of grace in the face of death, but to open up this dying in the presence of everybody else who might be hungering for this word. Mm-hmm. I think he found funerals and weddings to be some of the most evangelical of his preaching. Mm-hmm. And they were moving to me. And I think it's why Romans 8 is my all-time favorite text, because it was over and over at these funerals. Alex.
Well, you know, those, without depreciating what you have done or what we think we've done wrong, when there are such traumas or tragedies within the community, any of those, whether it be a family that has just gone through something or in a funeral homily, there are events of the person's life and the circumstances that are touchstones, windows, doorways to the universal human condition.
That's right.
And rather than dwell on that person, you can explain or review or whatever that which happened, but yet use that as a window to our condition, because our lives intersect with the grieving of that family.
Absolutely. That's incarnational preaching.
Very
much. That's saying,
yes,
this very life, we're not preaching this life, but this life in such a way that it opens a window and door onto your life and into our life together.
Nothing is more important than the preaching at a funeral.
Yeah. Do you think?
After burying 50 people in the congregation where I'm at in the 10 years I've been there, nothing is more important than what I do with that in that role, because that is when the gospel, it can be heard in most clear, most powerful way.
And Alex, I want to thank you for that, because that image of these touchstones, these real events in human time and history, becoming for us doors or windows or even metaphors to walk through that touch on the, that you said, the truly universal human condition, that it's addressed by God.
You know, and that's a litmus test for me too, in any story that I would incorporate in the first person singular.
Yeah, okay.
Is there a touchstone, a segue in that can relate and make this story your story? And if there isn't, then it's just talking about me. But if it opens up, aha, I can relate to that, because that's my shit too.
Yeah.
It makes a difference.
So is that sort of what you say? You tell the story and look out at them and say, this is your shit too?
Alex does.
Well, I mean, like what you were saying about your love story.
Yeah.
I think that's a poignant story, and how this perspective of us to take one person, that's all I could remember, and then therefore to say, well, because one person fixated on that, I can't ever do that again. I mean, somewhere we've got to give ourselves more credit. There are many who did hear that and will remember that. My God, I'm doing nausea and idolatry at the same time, you know?
Or it might end up preaching a gospel I hadn't intended to preach, which is, currently in this relationship, am I fooling myself about what real love is? Am I looking for butterflies and bridges when what I need is to look for some kind of real connection? So, yeah, you're right. That story could have had. I just am not sure that it. I had too much fun telling it, I think. Yes, Peter?
I'm a preacher turned two-sitter now.
Yeah, me
and
too.
I always wondered why the people responded so good when I gave them hell, you know, preach the law. They go, oh, good sermon, Bass, you know. But I found out now that when the gospel is preached, it's so filling that you can't really, you know, you can say good sermon, Pastor, but it so enlightens you, enriches you, that you just are just in awe.
I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we have to think that when we try to put too much into a sermon, we might be just going too far. I mean, we just need to preach the simple gospel that will just
hear from a wise man back there. And I'm not good at seeing.
Kimberly.
Well, I was just thinking about when you were talking about the funeral sermon being so important, and I agree with you. It's a moment when a family will really remember, you know, your presence, you know, as you carry them through this, and also what's said at the sermon. But I think that our whole life in the church and our preaching of the gospel is what helps prepare us for that moment. That if the gospel is preached well, that we will be more prepared for that death than otherwise. There, being a hospital chaplain, you can see the difference in families who have a groundedness and a faith that carries them, and a community that carries them through that period. And so our life together and our preaching along the way and knowing what we believe, or being able to say it's okay when I don't know exactly what I believe, but that God is still present with me. And that's really powerful. You know, this whole journey is powerful. And then to come through and be present with them in their crisis.
And
they will remember the crisis. Yeah.
And it's the entering into their lives at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it isn't just the event of the sermon, but the funeral. It is what, you know, and a lot of times we have the advantage of being able to be with that family through that cancer, through that, you know, long-term hospital stay that turns bad. If you're doing your job right, you were there with, you were a part of that family, and they know that. And they know that, and that's why they trust you. And that's why that opportunity to preach the gospel is so powerful. And not only that, the rest of the community, because it's not just that little family. So, you know, piggybacking what Alex says, you know, that's that event that allows you to enter into all of their lives, because they know you're there.
Daniel, and then I think we need to close. Doesn't something start at 7?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we'll start at 7.
Maybe a hard question, but it's simple to ask. But I've connected with Peter Story, who was the Methodist bishop of Johannesburg during the struggle, and who has been teaching at Duke University for several years, but in this column he wrote after 9/11, he felt that America was probably the hardest place on earth to preach. And he said it was much easier to preach in apartheid Africa, South Africa. And the reason he gave is that he said that Americans are so innocent, and they are also so kind and such wonderful people, and are wrapped in the American flag, and then are so naive about what is a collective society, the evil and the pain they cause in the whole world. So, you know, he kind of wept for the preachers of America that will be faithful, but somehow, how do you unwrap this, you know, loving gospel? Gospel way, because in some ways I think it's the hardest word right now in our society, and I don't. But this, I think it came because he was an outsider, you know, and living here.
Well, you hear over and over again people in deep need when they're dying, people when they're vulnerable, when they are just laid bare, people who are poor. People who are living on the streets, people who live in oppressive regimes, the gospel comes to them, like it did in Luke 4, as good news. And the first task for too many of us, for most of us, first task of the preacher is to convince the people that they really have a need for God. Because mostly we can go on without God and tell, oh gosh, we're the one with the diagnosis. Until, oh gosh, we're the one the terrorists attack. I mean, Christians and others living with that for generations. And that's the tricky thing, because we don't want to know that. And that doesn't make people feel happy. But there is no healing balm, you know, unless the wound is opened up. And I think to... As a
corporate group in North America, we just have a real thick scab over our wounds, and we're unaware of the festering that's going on. And maybe this crisis at this time in our nation is a crisis of splitting open that naivete and that innocence. If we can keep from simply responding out of self-righteousness and revenge, if we can actually hear this as the sword coming through to the way we have lived isolated, surrounded by what we own and the power we have and the way of life, I mean, it could be an incredible opportunity for really good news to enter people. But they will run you out of the church and to the cliff and throw you over. And as I understand from my papa the promise of Jesus, you'll pass through their midst and be on your way to another place. So peace and power to you in your preaching. Thank you for sharing this with me. We could do a week of talking about preaching with each other. But thank you.